Hello, everybody. You guessed it. Jughead here. Here we are on the 4 out of 5 episodes about Smoking Popes and their album Born to Quit. In order to have these episodes uninterrupted, I am putting the ad for Siren Records right here at the beginning. This song, of course, was recorded by D.I., a Southern California band, of which I think the singer is actually in the movie Suburbia.
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
Now we get to present to you our one and only advertiser, and this is Siren Records in McHenry, Illinois. I really love this place. My friend, the Linquists that run the record store, are a pretty great married couple. They're very passionate about their record store. It's a great place to visit. It's very homey, and they have a great selection of contemporary and classic music and rock and metal and a bunch of different passion projects. They're really into the Lillingtons and Teenage Bottle Rockets, so a lot of interesting posters and records from that gang. They also deal with cassettes, and they will buy old records and cassettes from you. And if you go into the back room, you see that they have an amazing selection of old and new stereos, record players, amplifiers, speakers. It's a pretty fascinating place, and they do a lot of repairs on things like that too. Got a staff that works there in this little cubby hole with all these amazing tools. Anyway, you can visit their website at www.sirenrecordsmchenry.com. You have to put the McHenry in there, M-C-H-E-N-R-Y. So once again, that's sirenrecordsmchenry.com.
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
So I'm going to give you the short version here, seeing that if you're listening to this episode of Mike Felemley, you've probably listened to the Caterer Brothers episodes already on Smoking Popes. This one was done quite a bit later. After doing the Caterer Brother interviews, I got a job offer in Japan, so I went back to Osaka. So a little bit later, I conducted the interview with Mike via Skype, and that was done on April 20th of 2019. I explained in the beginning of it, but seeing that there are already 3 interviews done before I got to Mike, this one was a little bit more specific and shorter, but definitely equally as entertaining and interesting. In listening back to this one, I was like, wow, that went really well. And we just got right to our business, said our business, and then said our goodbyes. You will also hear more from Mike in the last episode, where all 4 band members will talk about all of the songs on Born to Quit. But let's just dig right in. Here we go. Right now, you are listening to track number 7 on Born to Quit, Need You Around. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Jughead's Basement, subcategory Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests. This week, episode 129, we have Mike Felemley of The Smoking Popes. This week, we talk to Mike about being a Midwestern boy with transient roots, discovering punk through thrasher and skateboarding, the truth comes out about the trombone, working with brothers, fears of being replaced on a major label, returning to the Smoking Popes, Into the Agony, and Mike's very own The Rock Room. Plus, much more drummy drum drum more. Do it.
Wow, we're on the opposite sides of the world. It's like we're right next to each other.
Crazy.
So you're my last of these the interviews for the band. And what usually happens with the last of the interviews is I'm more searching for information to. It's easier for me to do it in a shorter amount of time, so I don't feel like you're less appreciated.
Cool.
I mean, my questions, I think, for you, Mike, are pretty vague. I might have some questions within those questions, but I'm not really concerned much. So, Mike, where were you born and raised?
I was born in Newark, Ohio, which is a little town like outside of Columbus. And I kind of grew up in various cities throughout Ohio, lived near Cleveland for a little bit, lived near Cincinnati for a little bit. We lived in Minnesota for like a year. And then we moved to Crystal Lake, Illinois when I was about 13. So 1980 something, we moved to Crystal Lake. And then that's pretty much where I stayed. I stayed in that area until just a few years ago, where I moved to Westmont, Illinois. And then I just moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin about a month ago.
Yeah, these are all Midwest areas. You're a Midwest boy from beginning to now.
Yeah.
I'm curious because people that move around quite a bit at first. Was that family work or was it a choice of where the job was leading your family or what was that like moving around a bit at first?
Yeah, we pretty much. We kind of just followed my dad's job around. He worked for the Sherwin-Williams Paint Company like his entire career. So he just started just in one of the retail stores and kind of kept getting promoted. So as he would get promotions, we would move to those places. It was a little weird, switching schools all the time. Every couple of years, switching schools was a little bit tough.
That's why I was wondering, because I know I spent my whole life in one elementary school, one high school. So I just wanted to know what you felt the difference was.
Yeah, especially like the older you get, I felt like the harder it was. Like the last move was I had finished up sixth grade and I was going into junior high. So that was probably the toughest.
Yeah.
Because by that time you've got like friendships that are a little bit more established. But in the end, I'm glad we ended up moving to Illinois versus where we were in Ohio. Like it was a better place to be. It's kind of where I came from. The last city I lived in Ohio was a little bit redneckish. I won't name the city's name so I don't slander the town, but
yeah,
it was like not too far from Kentucky. And it was like, it's one of those towns where like, if you're a guy and you make eye contact with another guy, like he's going to want to fight you, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I lived for a year right on the border there. I worked in Cincinnati for a puppet show. Uh-huh. And I would often go over the border to Kentucky because you can get better rum and stuff there, you know, and whiskey. But I know exactly what you're talking about. So,
yeah. So I think in the end, it was a good move. And if we hadn't moved, I wouldn't have met the Caterer brothers and probably all worked out for the best.
Speaking of which, did you find, did you come to like punk music in that styling before you had moved to Illinois? Did you have any familiarity with it?
I did. Yeah, it was crazy. And I think it was like 1983, 1984. And there was a town near where I lived called Middletown, Ohio, which is just a small, weird town. But there was a record store in the mall there that had an alternative section in 1984, which for a mall record store, that's pretty unheard of. You know, that's a good like 8 to 10 years before alternative became like a thing people knew of. And like, I was kind of into skateboarding. So I would always buy like Thrasher magazine. And then I would see ads in Thrasher for different bands. I had never heard these bands because, you know, there's no internet or anything, you know, and these bands don't play it on the radio, but I would go to that store and buy the tapes of the ads I saw in Thrasher. So some of the first tapes I bought were like the Descendants and the Replacements early stuff. So I kind of discovered punk like sort of accidentally that way.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I that's what I miss about going to record stores in those days where, you know, you would think on the internet I would find more random stuff, but maybe just I'm older now. But when I was in record stores, I was more excited about just grabbing any record I saw based on art or something, or just, you know, take more chances way.
Look at the cover art and you look at the song titles.
Yeah.
I didn't even really read like record reviews. I would just look at like the band name and what the art was and like, well, they're advertising it in Thrasher magazine. That's a cool magazine. It must be cool music. I'll probably like it.
with this podcast, it's for me, it's like an art project for me. So I'm not always just interested in music, but just creativity in general. So Mike, do you feel that any of your move to be a musician has come from any lineage in your family?
We don't really have any like hardcore musicians in my family. Like my mom's dad can like play the harmonica and her mom like plays piano in church. And then like my dad he might have drummed a little bit in high school. But he's not a musician, but he's always like one of those people that's always tapping on the table and stuff. But I think he was probably meant to be a drummer. Fortunately for my childhood that he wasn't, because he probably made a lot more money working for Sherwin Williams than he would have as a drummer. So I think like rhythmically, like, I don't know, my dad seemed, he's got the rhythm, like he could have been a good drummer. I think I kind of inherited that. And drums were the instrument I kind of went to first.
You know, that leads me to this other thing I usually say beforehand. Sometimes these questions will overlap, so just answer them as if it's for the first time, because I'm going to ask you now about when you first started drumming, and it's better to say, or yeah, like I said before. So let me ask the question first. So, well, here, actually, I have it stated this way. I think this is a little bit more interesting. Mike, were drums your first instrument, and when did you start playing?
Drums were indeed my first instrument. I started playing right about when I was in seventh grade, and I'd wanted a drum kit for a long time, and I had to work on my parents for months to be able to get one. And like Christmas was coming up, and I pulled the old like, I want a drum set or nothing. So if it's not a drum set, I don't get me anything. And luckily I have really nice parents and they bought me a drum set, and that's what started it. And I had no idea. I didn't even know how to like set it up. I didn't know where the hi-hats were supposed to go and where the snare was supposed to be. Like I had to bust out some old I had like a VHS tape of like the Cure videos.
Yeah.
I had to put that on and like see how that guy had his stuff set up. Like I didn't know how to even play a beat, like with doing the hi-hats and the kick and snare. Like I had a friend of a friend came over and like showed me a beat. And then I kind of picked that up. And then after learning that beat, I could kind of like hear that in the songs I was listening to. Taught myself from there on out.
Oh, so this is Mike. So you never had actually any structured lessons with a teacher. You just had some friend show you different parts and then just picked it up.
Yeah, I had one, like a friend of a friend who like, dude was like visiting from Texas. I don't even remember his name, but he knew like just the basic rock beat. And he came over and showed me, and like I picked that up. I'm like, okay, yeah, that makes sense now. And I taught myself for some years, and then I did take lessons after I'd been playing for maybe 3 or 4 years, since for about maybe 3 to 5 months. And that teacher wanted me to learn to read the drum music, which is pretty easy to read, but I still couldn't do it. And so I just came to the point where I'm like, weeks would go on and like he'd give me stuff to read and practice, and I would get to the lesson. And then I would just say like, well, could you just play it for me once? And then I would hear him play it, and then I would play it, and he's like, so you're not going to read this? I'm like, no. So, okay, well, I can't help you much more. I'm like, all right.
So you just had a little bit more of a natural inclination to just being able to just listen to something and try to just hammer it out for yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I was never – it's funny because I played fifth and sixth grade, I played the trombone in the school band. So I guess the trombone was technically my first instrument. I forget about that.
Ah, there's the truth.
Yeah, the truth comes out. But I play the trombone, and you know, you have the sheet music, but for a trombone, there's like slide positions. So I never learned to read the sheet music. I would just go through, and I had a little key that would show like what note was which slide position, and I would write the numbers across the top of all my sheet music. I would play based on that. And then if we had to learn a new piece in class, I would just like kind of fake it through like the first half of the song and listen to the other people and then just jump in when I felt like I knew how to do it, because I couldn't read the music then either.
I'm not surprised you came to punk. That seems like a very popular way to discover music for punks. The one thing I'm just always, you know, there's so many guitarists and even, you know, and a lot of people start. I mean, there's some real great bass players out there, but a lot of people also just start because it's the instrument that was easiest. And that's, you know, especially in punk, that's how it starts. I mean, I believe there's, you know, of course, way more technical way of playing a bass. But I'm curious. This question comes from this curiosity. Mike, is there something inherent in you that you think caused you to focus on percussion as your instrument?
I don't know. Like, there must be, like, even long before I got a drum set, like, I just wanted drums. I don't know why. Like, I can pinpoint, like, why that is, but, like, I just wanted drums. And I'm like, I don't even play drums for the last 15 years or so. Like, when I'm not playing in a band, I barely ever play the drums. Mm. But I tap on things all the time. Like, I'm a tapper. I just felt like I needed something to tap on harder than I could tap on a desk and louder.
I'm sorry, that just reminded me. Do you remember this? I can't remember if you went to like Dirty Nelly's shows or you're going to shows back around there in Palatine. But there was a kid that used to carry drumsticks in his back pocket. I don't know if he ever played in a band. I never saw him in a band, but he would always at every show like tap on his leg and on the items in front of him. I can't remember who he was, but that just reminded me of that. Vapid is a tapper too. Like I always thought he's had like a drummer instinct in him too, because he's always tapping.
Yeah, I feel like those people are all probably meant to be drummers. All the tappers.
Yeah. Before talking about Smoking Popes, can you talk a little bit about your path as a musician, prior bands or plans that you had to be a musician, or was it a plan to be a musician?
It became a plan kind of after I joined the Popes. It became the thing where I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And I didn't play in a whole lot of bands before that. I had like a couple of guys in high school that I jammed with, and we had a variety of names. Like, I think we started as Cardiac Arrest and then changed it to 3 Mile Island. So we did that for a little bit. And then we had my brother and a couple of buddies. We had a band called Article One. And that band, we opened for, it was right when the Popes had changed. It was the very first Smoking Pope show. I think maybe the only Smoking Pope show in the early years that I wasn't the drummer. Article One opened up for the Smoking Popes in Crystal Lake at like a, I don't know, I can't, it's called like the Bathhouse Hall. It was somebody's like private party thing. And we opened for them. So I think Article One was like my third band before the Popes. And then shortly after that show, the guy that was drumming with Speedstick in the first Pope show, like, kind of went missing for a time. And the caterers had seen me play at that show, and they had some shows coming up, and they just got a hold of me. Like, we can't find our drummer. Do you want to play a couple shows? I was like, yeah, okay.
Mike, this question is, Mike, this is one of those that might step a little bit on what you just spoke about, but just let's see where it goes afresh. So, Mike, who did you meet first from Smoking Popes, and how did this lead to the forming of Smoking Popes?
So I think Josh was probably the first one that I that I talked to, and I think he got my number from like a, because they went to a different high school. I went to Crystal Lake Central, and they went to Jacobs High School, and Jacobs was in Algonquin. And it was shortly after I had opened for them. And they got my number from this girl. And then, so I think Josh called me and was just like, hey, would you want to jam with us? And like in my mind at that time, like they were like a big band, even though they, Popes were not a big band at that time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But like they were bigger than Article One was. So I'm like, okay. In my first show with them, and at the time it was just a trio. It was me and Matt and Josh, because Eli wasn't allowed to be in the band yet. Their parents wouldn't let him be in the band yet at that time. And we played in Aurora, Illinois, at a place called the Club for the Deaf. So I think it was mostly to deaf people on top of a pool table. They put some plywood on top of a couple pool tables, and that was the stage. So I remember from it.
Wow. Yeah, you're the first one to mention that, so that's nice.
Yeah, I just remember it was like my first show with them, and like I was real excited for it because we actually were getting paid. We didn't get paid much. I think I made like 10 or 12 bucks, but I was, I think, 16 years old or 17 years old, and I had like 12 bucks that I made myself.
So, yeah, I know. That's great.
You know, with inflation, that's probably like $25, $30
to pay. Now. My next question, Mike, I just typed it out while you said something earlier that made me think about this, but I don't really know how to ask it, but I'm always curious about, and this isn't just about this early time period, it's, you know, from all your time in Smoking Popes, but how does, it's probably mostly Josh, but how do you work with a songwriter on how to, on what your drums should sound like? Is that an easy process? Do you just pick it up naturally, or do they have to like describe to you and like hit some drums like Ben Weasel used to do with Panic? What's your process with that?
With me and Josh, it's always been really very natural. And even with the whole band, like a lot of times when I was in high school, Josh actually lived at my house with my parents for a couple years, kind of in the early days. A lot of it was around when we were making Born to Quit. Mm-hmm. And I had a 4-track at the time. So we'd be just sitting around doing nothing. And I'd be like, Josh, let's record. So he's like, okay, I'll go write something. And he would like run up to his bedroom. He'd come down 20 minutes later. He's like, I got something. And then he would just like strum it out on guitar. And I would just do the beat. And like, I don't think there's really ever been a time to our entire career where Josh told me like a beat to play. So I must have always just played what he was hearing in his head.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Because I've worked with songwriters later on where the songwriter had like specific things that they wanted. But I know with Josh's stuff, like drumming his songs has always been super natural for me. Like I feel like he and I must just click on a rhythmic level. Because and you know, the other two guys being his brothers, we usually have a song. Like if he's got a new song and he brings it to practice, usually by like the third time through it, it's like almost what it ends up being as a final product. Because it just seems like everybody just kind of knows what to do. You know, throughout the years, it's been refined more. But I think we were all pretty new on our instruments when we started together. So throughout the years, we kind of learned to play our instruments while playing together. So like we kind of learned how to be musicians by being that band, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's kind of, I can't think of a non-corny way to say it, but it's like you created your own language, you know, because you were growing up together as musicians. So you probably have your own little terminologies of how to, you know, get through something.
Yeah, because occasionally, like, we'll get, like, through a song, like, a couple times, and then somebody might say, like, oh, what if we stop right here or change this part like that? But like, there's usually two or three little tweaks, and then it's like, it's done. You know, play with some other writers and bands where it's definitely a lot more involved than that, and there's a lot more talking about what's going to happen in the songs, and, like, we don't really have to converse much about it. Like, when there's the song always starts with, like, Josh playing it for us on an acoustic, and then we listen to that, and then we turn the amps up and grab the drums and just play it. And it usually just comes out how it's supposed to be.
I'm also very curious as to the bass and the drums, you know, because a lot of, and not always in punk, but in like a lot of other music forms and also in punk, but the bass and the drums, you know, are working together as a team, like the foundation of a song. Did you have that sort of relationship with the bass and the drums?
Yeah, definitely. And if you listen to our recorded material, it really starts to solidify around Born to Quit. Like, I think everything up to Born to Quit, there's good stuff there, but it's like all kind of sloppy because we didn't fully know what we're doing. You know, I mean, we're really young kids and just learning how to like play instruments.
Yeah.
Even though somehow like Josh could already shred at that time. Josh could do really shredding solos, but we didn't know how to like play as a band. And so I think around the time when we made Born to Quit, we kind of made a conscious decision at that time to make like a less punk album. And I think it's because you were in the scene in those days and we were already like kind of on the fringe of whether or not we were going to be accepted by the punk scene anyway. So we're like, why don't we just make a record that's just like not punk and like slow it down and actually like play tight. And I know we'd had some of those conversations when working with Phil. I'd had a lot of like one-on-one conversations with Phil Bonet about like what the drums should do in a song, like how they should be. And I know Matt was in on some of those conversations, and that's when like Matt and I kind of made a deliberate focus to kind of like, you know, lock in the kick pattern and the bass lines together and that kind of stuff. And before that, we didn't even really know that that was like a thing that maybe you should do. Like we just were kind of learning that at the time.
Yeah, I remember learning that in Weasel too. Like I think the one of our who was best at that was later on in the band, actually during Wiggle with Johnny Personality or John, you know, Stockfish. That he's the one that sort of brought that sort of feel into the band where I started realizing, I mean, the huge difference when the bass player starts actually following the drums.
Yeah, it's just like it just sounds a lot better. The whole thing sounds better when like the bass and the kick drum are like doing like a remotely similar thing together. It just like locks in the bottom end and kind of makes when that's happening, the guitars can kind of do whatever they want to do out there. That's where I think the bass gets way overlooked as an instrument in terms of like how hard it is to play.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
People often think like the bass is easier than the guitar, but I would argue that to be a great bass player requires like 300% better rhythm than being a guitar player does.
Yeah, I definitely think that guitars are allowed to be way more messy than a bass is. A listener that doesn't know music might not be able to tell that, but I still feel they can instinctively like feel something like there's something amiss.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's even before we knew how to do that or that we should do that, we would notice that like our stuff doesn't sound as tight as like Green Day. Get Fired is not as tight as like Kerplunk is. And we didn't quite know why until we figured out that like the rhythm section actually has to like that was our responsibility to make it tight.
This next question is going to take a slight away from that. Then we're going to come back to Solid Sound and Phil with the question after this one. But Mike, from your experience in bands, has there been any significant difference in how a band of brothers is run from a band of friends or just like business partners?
It is quite a bit different, but it's a very tricky way to explain. I think it's also different because like the Caterer brothers are all three like pretty unique individuals.
Yeah.
I guess all four of us are.
Yeah.
But they all have their quirks, and their quirks are very similar yet totally different. But as a result, like there are certain things that our band doesn't do well because like we all kind of share similar weaknesses. So like communication has been a struggle throughout the last 25 years or whatever. We're slightly better at it these days, but still not great. And it's because we all have kind of like the same faults. Maybe it's because I grew up with them. So I'm 16 years old throughout my 20s, spent the majority of my time with them like on the road and doing stuff. So we all have this one way about us. And like, I feel like bands that get huge have someone in the band that's like a salesperson, like a charisma type person. Like if you look at, and they're not massive huge, but if you look at like MXPX, you have like Mike Herrera, who is like outgoing and he's like the salesman of the band. You know, he's always doing like videos of himself on social media. And like our band, like it's because it's three brothers and me who are all kind of introverted. Like we don't have that guy. we don't have like the extroverted, like, salesperson guy that's going to drive the thing.
Yeah.
So we've always kind of like gone along and just done our thing, and it's worked to a certain degree, but I think Maybe if we had a little bit more dynamic makeup of personalities, we would have become more commercially successful, possibly.
Yeah, I think about that a lot when I think back on with Weasel, with me and Ben, because you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, it was the right time, or you guys had a sound that wasn't as popular then. And I think it's because him and I were both actually business minded. It actually surprised both of us, but we were very driven business wise. And like you said, he had that sort of over the top, charismatic, you know, assholery that charmed people. But I was sort of the quiet business partner in the back. But I think that it kicked it up a notch on how well we did, because we had that element.
Yeah, it's definitely like the bands that got the bigger bands. And I mean, I'm sure there's always outliers to that scenario. But I mean, if you look at Green Day and you have, like, Billy Joe is like totally outgoing, like charismatic guy, at least from a public view. Most bands have that guy, and we didn't. Like, I was always pretty hardcore focused on the business side too. Like, I was always into the numbers. Even when we were on the major label and stuff, I always wanted to get the sound scan reports and see all the numbers. But I think it's just that, you know, none of us are, and our live show has developed over the years, and I think these days it's better than it ever was. But in the early days especially, I think we were a little too kind of reserved and in our own little shell as a live band.
To me, I feel that's almost like crucial to the sound, sort of is like that sound. Like, it has this soothing vocal over this intense music. So it, to me, it lends itself to that sort of more of a band feel where no one is trying to stick out or anything like that.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's just unfortunate that we couldn't take what our live show has turned into now and take that back to like 1994. Because Josh is just these days just much more comfortable. He's just way more comfortable on stage. The whole band is, so the whole show. And still, we don't have anybody like that's like a freak up there, but it's like a much more entertaining and well thought out performance now than what we had in the early days. Well, and plus, nobody, we don't drink anymore, which probably helps things.
That is true. This isn't quite a question, more just an open forum to say some thoughts on working at Solid Sound Studio, and specifically with, I've had all the caterers talk about working with Phil, so I'd like to get your some of your words on Phil too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think working with Phil Bonet was like probably the single most influential and impactful thing to me as a musician, and even to some degree like as a person. I don't think there's anybody, especially musically, that it has inspired me more than Phil did. You know, I met him at, I was pretty young and impressionable, and he was good at what he did. And we would go in there and just do these marathon sessions. You know, we would like start at noon and go till 3 a.m. And like, we'd be, I don't know what Phil was drinking. He's probably drinking coffee, but we were all drinking like Mountain Dew and chain smoking in the control room. And then like he would work till his ears are fried, and then we would stop and sit there and talk about recording and music until like 4 or 5 a.m. and then like do it again. And just, it's hard to pin down like at a particular thing, but just in those discussions, I feel like I learned more about how to be a musician from those than from any other element of playing music in my career.
Yeah, I out of all the engineers I've worked with, he's the one that just seemed more, just so natural. And what I talked about, I think, with Eli is that the willingness to, that old thing about mistakes becoming the actual solution to a song or to creativity. He seemed really open to that sort of idea, and actually had a very good eye for knowing when it would work or not.
Yeah, and what was so great about Phil is that like he would only interject himself like as much as you wanted him to. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of times you would have to really kind of twist his arm to get his, because I think he kind of had almost like a Steve Albini approach in that way, where he was going to let the band sound like the band. He's kind of documenting how you sound. But then when you would like kind of tug on him a little bit and pull his opinion out, then he would have like a lot of these great opinions and ideas. Especially with being a drummer from the time between like Born to Quit, and then we were, after that, we were going into record Destination Failure, and that was going to be the major label album. And I was real paranoid that I was going to get fired from the band by the producer, because that's what happened a lot in the 90s.
Yeah, I know.
You go to make your major label album and the drummer can't cut it because he can't play to a click and his tempo's not right. And so I had some really long discussions with Phil about like what I needed to do as a drummer to like prepare to make a record with Jerry Finn, who's like kind of notoriously hardcore about drummers. So I think, you know, without being able to get Phil's like counseling on all that, I don't think I would have been able to transform my playing into a way that was going to be acceptable for like a major label production during that time. Like we kind of started working on Born to Quit, and you can listen, if you listen to Get Fired, it's like a drum fill bonanza. Like I barely ever played beats. I was just doing fills the whole time because I thought that's, if you know how to do them, you should just be doing them. Right? I didn't know. Like just do all the fills you know how to do. It's the whole point of playing.
So the band actually demanded that Phil have his hands in part of that session too, right? So he was,
yes,
he was around. Yeah.
He engineered like all the drums. We had another session at the end of that one where we did like I Know You Love Me, Before I'm Gone, and Let's Hear It for Love. But outside of those three songs, like Phil engineered the drums and bass and a lot of the guitars on most of that record. And it was super comforting to have him there in the studio with us because it was more like having like an extra member of the band. Like he was kind of a like our comforting, like a blanket from home or something to have Phil there.
That's great, Mike. You actually brought out some cool things that I hadn't gotten from the other boys. So that was lovely. Yeah, I'm going to try to have a whole section just on Phil in the podcast. So because I really missed him, too. I worked with him. And he was one of my favorite people that I worked with, I think, in punk rock.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever. I was pretty young when he passed, like in my 20s. And I've never had the loss of a person like affect me the way that one did. Because he was just, I recorded some of my very first like solo music with him as well. And like whenever I would write a song and like record one, I would always bring in like my 4-track recordings and like get his opinion. And like he was the guy I was trying to get his like approval, like on my own recordings and stuff. Like, this one's good. I want Phil to hear this one. And like he was that guy for me, like the kind of my motivation to do things better and like try to impress Phil. Like that was my goal as a young like songwriter and musician.
This next thing, Mike, is something it's gnawing at me, and I'm asking this to each one, and it's slightly like a question I asked before, but here I'm just going to say this. I wrote down a lot of thoughts, and it may lead to an answer to you having an answer. But let's see what happens. So I'm just going to read everything I wrote here. Brothers in most respects have to deal with each other. They will always be brothers, and so may be more willing to deal with conflict between each other. Did this make it harder I'm talking about you in the third person. Harder for Mike being the one, not the brother? Josh's answer, he had a difficult time answering this, being interested in the concept, but he didn't know if it applied to the band. But he did later say in the interview that when you were gone, Mike, something just didn't feel right, and that he realized that he considered you like a brother and crucial to the feel of the band. How do you respond to this?
I would say I think at times, especially when we had some challenging times towards the end of the band, in our later Capitol Records days, or kind of in the height of our Capitol Records days, and Josh was having some anxiety issues, and we were like canceling some shows, and felt like Matt and Eli were always kind of just, I felt like this probably because I wasn't a brother, but like they were always just going to like go that way, whichever way Josh wanted to go at the time. Mm-hmm. So I think in the good times, I didn't think it really made much of a difference being a brother or not. But I thought when there were really tough moments in the early years, I thought that it was maybe you feel a little bit like an odd man out. But I would say like when I came back into the band, it did feel really natural. And like the first song that we played together kind of felt like it was like just as tight as it had been like the 15 years prior, whenever the hell the last time I'd played with him was, or 17 years. I can't remember how long it was.
Wow. I didn't even think it was that long. You know, I don't know. The time just goes by. Yeah. Wow. It was that long. Like, huh?
98 to 2015.
Yeah, that's, yeah, 17 years, yeah. 17 wow.
17 years, yeah. So when they first got back together without me, I was, like, a little bit bummed about that. And I think in that regard, it would be different because had I been a brother, they probably would have just asked me to be back when they first got back together.
Right.
Because they all had issues with each other, but they're all brothers, so they still had to, like, see each other and deal with each other because you're brother. And if you're not a brother, like, and you don't like that guy at that time, you can just not deal with him.
Right.
On the whole, I think it's been fairly equitable, though. Like, when you compile all the years, I think it's, we've, you know, when you play with the same people for so long and some of our family or not, like, you kind of become a family and it's all kind of, it ebbs and flows. So I think, yeah, I guess I'm almost a default. I'm like one third caterer, maybe.
But, well, to me, maybe it feels like you still, it's nice to have someone who's a little bit of the outsider, but still, you know, has got his feet in the brotherhoodness, you know, mm-hmm. to have a little perspective.
Yeah.
I love the new record, Into the Agony. I think it's really great. And I'm also surprised that 17 years later, because it sounds just as fresh and as energetic and as intense as the earlier stuff. This is about Born to Quit, but I think I'd be amiss if I didn't just ask just for a couple quotes on how it feels with the new record, Into the Agony. Not a specific question, just what's your thoughts on that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think it was a really fun record to make, and the way we made Into the Agony, I feel like was kind of a throwback a little bit to how we did our recordings like Born to Quit and prior to that, where we didn't do it all in one long straight session. You know, like Destination Failure was recorded like for weeks and weeks consecutively. Mm-hmm. And Born to Quit was made like, we'd do some shows, make some money, and do a session, do like two songs. And then we would do it over a period of months, doing a couple songs at a time as they were written and as we were ready. And the new record kind of made that same way. You know, we didn't have like one long week where we just tracked everything. We would do it like two or three songs at a time. And we did all the rhythm guitars, bass, and drums were like recorded together at the same time, which is how we used to do it, you know, on Get Fired and Born to Quit and even on The Party's Over. And I think that brings a much kind of livelier and more kind of, I hate the word organic, but like it just sounds like a band playing that way. I played to a click on most songs, but we didn't like quantize any of the stuff like people are doing now. So I think it just has more of the kind of, it feels like a 90s record, but just sounds a little bit better because it was recorded today. But we made it in our kind of 90s Pope's way, where we'd practice the songs and we'd have two or three that we thought were good enough to record. And we would just go in for an evening and track all the rhythm parts to two or three songs in one go. And then we would wait a couple months and do it again.
Yeah, I was thinking about that process. And there's parts that could say that's hard to have to wait that long and just, you know, have to re-pick up the energy. But the other part to me is you sort of have a built-in critical eye on it because you're actually hearing it build over a longer period of time and you're able to maybe get some distance from it and look at it. And so I think that's an interesting process. And that combined with recording stuff live as a band, I think is an interesting combination.
And unusual to do like these days to have like all the rhythm tracks be recorded together. Cause usually you'll track drums and the producer will like edit the shit out of the drum tracks, put it, slap it, quantize it to the grid and like dehumanize it. And then you'll have the bass player do his tracks and you'll edit the shit out of those. There really is almost no like editing happening on that record. It's just like us playing.
Just as a side note, well, even in Blackouts, my, you know, band now of 17 years, has sort of done, I like that live feel too. I think all some of the best Weasel records we've done were just us in a room, you know, playing together, like Anthem and My Brain Hurts. But this last record, we went completely back to that process too, and we just did everything. We recorded all live together. And people are saying it's like the best sound they've heard, and no one knows that. But I'm like, that's probably why we went back to being a band, you know?
Yeah, it gets a different feel than you can get when you're stacking the tracks all independently, I think.
This actually leads nicely into, I wanted to get a little bit in here, Mike, about your project Live from the Rock Room, because that is bands recording live. So just say a few words about that.
Yeah, so that's a project I started a few years ago. Like, I have a home studio, and I would just, I just got the idea, like, my room there sounded really good, so I'm like, why don't I have bands come in here, and I'll have them play, and I'll record it and shoot it on video. And so I did the Popes first, as we were like the guinea pig, just to see if it would look and sound okay, and it did. So I just started inviting a bunch of like local and touring punk bands as they came through Chicago, and now as they come through Milwaukee, I'm almost have it put together here up in Milwaukee now. I'll have a band come in, they'll play three or four songs, and it's same deal. Like, I don't edit anything. We don't do any like punching in. You can't fix mistakes. It's just the band song as they played it. And I use a pretty light touch when I'm mixing it. You know, I'll EQ it so it sounds nice, but I'm not putting like samples in there or anything.
Yeah.
So it just sounds like the band playing in a room. So the sessions that sound really great, that's because that band sounds great. And the ones that sound not as great, that band didn't sound that great. It sounded as good as you sound.
Well, it sounds like you've taken little nods to Phil's experience with you.
Yeah.
Letting the band be the band.
Yep.
I'm going to put a link to that once the podcast is released, so you'll have that.
Darker than
look at you meeting me here at the end of this podcast. Strange, isn't it? But thank you for making it all the way through. The eighth track on Born to Quit, Can't Help the Teardrops, parentheses, From Getting Cried, unparentheses. Thank you, everybody. I will shortly mention the Patreon. Go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com and press that button that'll take you to the Patreon website, and you can sign up at the $2, $5, or $10 tiers. There's a new option where you could pay for a whole year all at one go, which would be great. Do that for me. Thank you.
You get extra stuff like unedited videos, and you get some free shit in the mail, and shit like that, and other stuff like that. Maybe even crap like that. If you can't afford to do that, we all understand. We all here at Jughead's Basement, me, that is, I understand. So just share the episodes with friends or enemies or plastic forks or even sporks. And you can also leave a star review at werewolf.com. There probably is a werewolf.com, so don't leave it there. Or do. But you should leave it at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It is even better if you leave an actual review with words and sentences and grammar, whatever that is. Have you ever dissected this? I was going to say, have you ever dissected a sandwich? But I meant, have you ever dissected a sentence in your grown-up life? I have, in a play once. That's it. Upcoming next, we have my friend Mark Linsenmeyer from the philosophy podcast, The Partially Examined Life. And I also just got an interview with Perry Grip from Nerf Herder. So that'll be upcoming too. And I'm still also in conversations with Fred Armisen. He just sent a message today that said next week will probably be good for an interview. So that should be upcoming also. Last in the series of Smoking Popes, we will have all four of the band members talking about all of the songs. That might take a little while for me to compile together, so it might be a few more weeks or 2 weeks at least before that is released. Very exciting. 5 episodes just for the Smoking Popes, Born to Quit. Amazing. All right, see you on the other end.